Hello?
Hello, Amanda?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Joanne.
Hi, I'm so happy to be talking.
Well, we managed to connect at last.
I know,
not a problem
I said,
about yesterday.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Don't feel bad. I was thinking about the last time, well, I was thinking about when I met you, which I think has to have been about 10 years ago. Through Mark Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
We had lunch together, and I think at the time you were writing.
I was doing a lot more writing.
Mm-hmm. And so I thought about what's transpired in your life, both personally and professionally, in such a short period of time, and I find it pretty amazing. You seem to have gone through all of these changes in your life seamlessly, and it's impressive.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, there's always the behind-the-curtain scene, but hindsight does provide a certain amount of grace to gel things together.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? I'd be interested in going back to your earlier years when you were young, and I think you were living in Seattle, in the
mm-hmm.
Seattle area. I'm interested to know when and how art began to enter your life.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. I think when I look back even further, growing up, you know, I was always excited in doing small craft projects about how I could manipulate color relationships. So, like most young girls, I would make friendship bracelets. But one of my favorite parts of it was picking out the colors and picking out the color sequence of you know, how the color would be laid out in the bracelet and seeing how one color would change another color. And so those were some of, like, I think the earliest seeds of maybe where my natural talent was. But it really wasn't until high school where I was fortunate enough to kind of have, you know, maybe one of my first divine interventions. This was my high school art teacher. And I wasn't somebody who could, you know, draw naturally. And I think at that young age, you know, kind of growing up in the suburbs, you think of an artist as somebody who could render. You know, they could render the person sitting in front of them or a face, and that wasn't me. But it was through this woman, Sandra Avery, that I discovered that art could be taught, that she could teach me those skills, that I could apply those skills, I could work at it, and kind of come to that space. And so, you know, that was the door being open, and I was kind of invited in, and then from there, I was able to pursue my own self-expression. And so I had pretty quickly started to go above and beyond, you know, class assignments that were given. And I was making paintings at home that weren't assignments, and I would bring them in, you know, to show her and talk about them. And at that point, you know, as a young teenager, you know, like many, I was going through many different emotional upheavals. And it was really in making art, kind of late at night, you know, when the world quiets down and the house quiets down, and I could be in my room, or I could go into the, you know, our garage and set up for the night and make a linoleum print and kind of take over the space that I think some of my more powerful moments as a image maker and someone wanting to express themselves started to take hold.
Was there anyone else in your family that was artistic or craft oriented?
I mean, my dad could draw. Like, he was an avid comic book collector.
Okay.
In a certain sense, there was, you know, visual culture around in that sense. I wasn't mm-hmm. reading his comics per se, but they were always around, or he would have me help him inventory them, you know, manually. And so there was that sense about it, but there wasn't, in growing up, like, a sense of fine art.
I see. Do you ever go back and look at work you produced through the years? Do you go back from the beginning and and peruse what you've produced?
You know, I have a couple of standout pieces that, you know, either my mom had them or some friends had them. And I'm kind of counting up until I was maybe 21 when I then went off to private art school in earnest. But, you know, unfortunately, most of, and I know my mom has some stuff up in the attic, which is long overdue for me to go through, but, you know, Hurricane Sandy had happened, and at that time I was in transition between post-grad school life and being at the McDowell residency, that I'd had a lot of stuff in storage. Most of my whole artistic history was in storage, and it got flooded. So I don't really have the ability.
Oh, what a shame.
To go back through. I do, like I said, there are things kind of planted with different people in my life from those earlier years that I can go visit. But it's not a wide...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really sad you lost so much valuable work.
Yeah.
When you do see work that you produced some time ago, what do you think? How do you feel?
I think the pieces that I see are when I was still kind of tied to some form of representation. And they're powerful pieces. You know, there's maybe a lot of self-portrait. You know, I was really influenced by the German Expressionists in high school and really focused on them in my own, like, study, independent study, and for, you know, a large senior project we had to complete. And so I see a lot of that kind of bold expression, you know, of suffering, you know, of kind of inner turmoil. And so, you know, when I look at that work, I'm appreciative that I was able to find my way to be able to express myself at that time, and it really did save me. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of locked into a lot of personal aspects of my life in those late teenage years. So I really kind of see it as, I mean, salvation's not a word I use often, but I'm not finding another word that's quite as powerful to describe that that moment. So, I mean, it's kind of locked into this period of when everything changed in my life.
Well, it was transformative.
Yeah, and things were turning in a way that was positive. You know, while
mm-hmm.
I'm still expressing things that are maybe emotionally difficult, it was kind of the beginning of something totally new for me.
It's interesting here you talk about the color, you're interested in color and working threads, making those bracelets, because I wanted to ask you, what elements do you see have persisted through the development of your artistry? And certainly thread is among them. Are there others?
Yeah, well, this is actually where I get really hopeful when I do get to spend some time with younger artists, and you can see the seeds of what they're working with, and maybe they're not at any arrival points yet, but, you know, when I look at some of my work from undergrad, you know, maybe a little bit more forward in time, I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, which is very cafeteria style. You can go and take classes in any department. And I was taking classes in the photo department, painting, printmaking. But even in my photos, I was stitching onto the photos. You know, I was trying to find a way of combining mediums in the sense that, you know, my experiences aren't kind of one-dimensional. They don't, you know, many things are coming together, and I wanted to show that. And so
mm-hmm.
while those are not great pieces, seeing the seeds of them in there now, again, a gift of hindsight where you're like, oh, I was really trying to work it out, you know, and it took years to kind of get to the place, you know, that I ended up in grad school with all these materials coming together and painting. But I think you know, one of the things about being young and growing up where I did, which was mostly in the Pacific Northwest, so I could talk about material influence, you know, as a young person. But I think the other biggest influence was just growing up around epic, big, sturdy landscape. And I think that that kind of has the biggest impact on my shape making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did a lot of road trips. We'd go camping, you know, out into the mountains on, you know, different rivers. And so more than like a material, I feel like that experience maybe has one of the biggest impacts on, you know, how I ended up working with the type of abstraction I work with.
It interests me always when I enter a studio to look for those seeds that you speak of from some of the earliest work and to see how that those seeds are planted and how they develop. If I don't see those seeds, I come away concerned. Hmm. And so, you know, you speak directly to the importance of recognizing within your own work your own growth from the beginning. And that's why I asked you about going back and looking at older work, because hopefully you see something there that is now flourishing in your current body of work. And I think that's really important to, for me, to, when I go into a studio, to witness.
Thing that happened with my education and shift when I was in undergrad was that I started to learn that the art I was making didn't have to center on me, that I could still have something to say without me or some other representational entity being a catalyst for communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at my early work, you know, late high school and then pre-Art Institute of Chicago, you know, it is still very much, you know, portrait or representational, but I'm looking at the shapes and they're like, they're bold, clear, sturdy images in the same way that my abstraction was kind of transformed in that way.
Well, I remember when I first saw your work, that what is so striking are these shapes and the boldness of the shapes and the boldness of the color. So it's persisted and it's part of who you are. It's part of the environment you've lived in and the life that you've lived. And it's sort of your DNA. And I think that's, for me, that's really important to be able to identify. How would you characterize your studio?
My studio right now?
In general.
Wow, no one asked that question ever. It's like you're asking me to describe my skin.
Okay.
In the sense that it's so a part of me, you know, it's kind of this sanctuary is maybe cliche, but it's like where I show up to do battle, where I show up to be alone, to be quiet. And it's where I have the potential to find something new. So, I'm trying to think about it, how to describe.
Well, you know, different artists work in different kinds of spaces. Some are meticulous in need and have a certain order and a certain standard approach in their studios. Others, it's more chaotic. I find they're all different.
I think from a, like, practical sense, you know, I'm pretty lucky I have, like, a relatively large space in Brooklyn. And, you know, when I'm in the midst of making, stuff is everywhere. And to me, I kind of put the hierarchy of what the work needs before, you know, like I have some friends who, like, the aesthetic of their studio is very important to them. Whereas for me, my studio is very functional. You know, there's tools out, there's stuff everywhere when I'm making. You know, at this point, my practice has changed quite a bit in the last year. And so I may be, like, working on multiple pieces at a time, where usually I would kind of focus on one piece at a time. And so now that, you know, there's kind of stuff in different states of making, all over. And then after I kind of round off, you know, a body of work or a series of maybe working on 4 to 6 pieces at one time, I'll kind of clear the deck again and clean everything out and give myself space to draw and think again, and then kind of, you know, start pulling out all the resources and pulling out the materials again and going back in.
What role does drawing play in your process, in your practice?
It's everything. Without drawing, I have no shape. I often describe drawing as a way to think through my hands and a way to dislodge from my own personal, like, inner aquifer of experiences, these shapes. And I really believe that my hands are quite potentially more intelligent than my mind. That, you know, we carry intelligence in our bodies, and we're not used to quantifying that in society as easily. And it's really through the drawing, you know, that I find these shapes. And sometimes I really know where they come from an emotional, psychological, physical, historical sense. And then there's other times they stay deep and mysterious to me. Other times a conversation with somebody who's looking at the work can unlock, you know, their origin or their influence. But for me, it's really the kind of naked moments of drawing. You know, there's no fabric choices to be made. There's no painting choices to be made. It's really kind of contending with my humanness in a very quiet way when it comes time to draw.
And, that, you know, that humanness that you speak of is exactly what takes me to the work as a collector. It's my body memory. It's what I, the history I carry in my body that connects with what's in yours.
You know, and I've had this experience where people have told me, like, highly personal stories about their bodies. You know, when having a studio visit or looking at my work in an exhibition, you know, things they maybe weren't prepared to tell someone else. And for me, one of my main attractions to abstraction is I find that I have the potential to talk to the most amount of people with my shape. And that in narrative painting, I would feel more hemmed into, you know, who could relate to it.
And it's the same from the viewer's point of view. I have a hard time with narrative because it's too directing. I need the abstract because I need to bring myself to the viewing to connect mm-hmm. with the work. And I don't want to be dictated through the narrative. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Have you done artist books? Do you keep journals? Are other forms of note-taking and drawing that are part of your practice?
Yeah, I've gone through, like, varying periods over the last 10 years of writing every morning. You know, I go through, and usually when I'm in an artist residency, I can be very disciplined because there's no excuse. I have all the time. So I write, you know, almost every day in the morning. And then in my various, you know, seasons within the city life, you know, I can focus more and write, or other times I can't. But on and off, there's lots of journals all over.
Do you tend to buy the same kind of journal and just keep them, store them, or does it vary a lot?
It varies. I may go through a phase where I like a certain journal for a period mm-hmm. of time, and then suddenly there's a different journal around when I need to start writing in a new one. But, there's different phases of the journal.
And what does the journal give you? What do you take away from these spontaneous moments of just sitting down and letting your ideas and thoughts flow?
I mean, there's times where memories come out and then those spark new ideas, experiments, you know, maybe things no one's ever going to see. But that doesn't matter because you don't know where an idea is going to lead to. You can't self-edit the minute you have an idea. You have to go actually implement the idea and experiment with it in reality and with your hands. And so there's definitely moments where maybe I'm reflecting on something I'm thinking about or that I have done in my studio, and then that leads to other thoughts. In other ways, it's just a way for me to process the emotional landscape of whatever relationships I'm engaged with at that time. Different transitions happening in my life, I often have to, you know, utilize those tools. And I really see, like, morning writing as a tool in different transitions I've had to face.
So in observing this process of journaling in many artist studios, I come away with the question, and I ask this of graduate students often, do you think it's possible for an artist to reach their greater potential without putting pen to paper in that form?
Without putting pen to paper?
Yes.
Ooh, that is.
And I mean that metaphorically, you know, pen to paper, whether you're drawing, whether you're writing, journaling, because I'm just curious.
You'd have to have a very different method of self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's ultimately, for me, you know, what I think it is. And I think about the ability to try to see yourself objectively. And I think that the pen to paper offers that potential. It's hard to think about not ever having that type of tool to use.
Right, right. Well, it's a question, you know. I mean, I have my own theory on it, but I do think it's essential. But I see very few cases where it's not present among successful artists.
I thought about immediately the book by the sculptor Anne Truitt. Her book.
I read it. I love that book.
Oh my gosh, that is one of the best books written by an artist.
It is.
You mentioned writing. I have to try to not hold myself to that standard.
You mentioned artist residency, and so I want to know what you think about artist residencies as they apply to personal artistic growth.
I mean, I can only speak from experience. To me, they are essential, especially in the postgraduate phase. I mean, obviously, I don't even know what it's like to be an artist at other phases of my life yet that I haven't lived. But in the postgraduate and then into emerging artist phase, they've been essential, and I've always prioritized them. And since graduate, I mean, actually, even in graduate school, you know, one summer I went to Yaddo, and I came out of grad school hitting the ground running with, you know, residency at McDowell Colony. And then it just kind of went on and on. Every year I try to get away, once a year and spend that time with myself. You know, it's, as someone who lives in New York City, it can be very loud, on so many levels, socially, your work demands, and to be able to extract yourself from your life and go be quiet with yourself and, you know, meet new peers is a community aspect of it, which I could go on about, but really it's that time to be quiet and find new ideas. And then I'm able to start working on them there and make tons of progress, but then I can also take that back to the city with me, and I have all this content to mine for a long period of time. You know, my friends, you know, this is just to put it, you know, very honestly, my friends who, for whatever reasons, weren't able to make that space for themselves, you know, they haven't maybe had some of the progress they would like to see in their work and their career. And I really attribute my time at residencies to, you know, you make a body of work and it becomes your passport for the art world and for your career. And it leads to opportunities. But if you don't have that good body of work, you don't have your passport.
I think from a collector point of view, I'm always interested to follow an artist's work after they've done a residency.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm looking for transitional moments. I'm looking for growth, some nuance or new ideas. And typically after a residency, I'll always see it in time. I mean, it may not happen immediately, but within a year or year and a half or so, you begin to see some new ideas emerge, which
yeah.
seemingly come directly from the residency experience.
Yeah.
I remember
I can pinpoint specific moments of influence or things that would never have happened in my work if I hadn't have been in certain situations, locations, points of interest and influence, they wouldn't have happened. And there's times where you can be very clear about it, and then there's times where it is more nuanced, the effect of a place or the effect of that time alone.
Can you give an example of one that you recall that was pretty profound?
Yeah, well, so when I went to Bemis Center for Contemporary Arts in Omaha, Nebraska, pretty shortly after I got there, I was directed over to the Quilt Museum Research and Study Center in Lincoln at the university there, which is the largest quilt museum in the United States. You know, and I was able to see their collection. It was National Quilt Day, which I couldn't get into any of the talks. They were totally, like, booked. But I was able to get some really amazing books that they had published. You know, there's these huge anthologies. And it was in that, taking them back to my studio, that, you know, I had spent a lot of time traveling to go study textiles all over the world, Peru, Cambodia, Bali, Turkey. But, you know, those are other people's cultures. I wasn't going to put that in my work. I wasn't going to just appropriate something that wasn't mine. But it was in coming to the quilt and it, you know, being such a multi-layered American culture that I was able to say, oh, I can quilt, I can like play with color in almost a Bridget Riley way with these quilt patterns and put those into the shapes of my pieces. Because, you know, I was sewing fabric at that time, as I still am, you know, into canvas. And so that was, you know, a very specific moment that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, if I hadn't have been there. Or maybe it just would have taken me longer to get to that moment, but that opened the door, like,
right.
completely.
Right. You know, you're so virtuosic with, is that a word, virtuosic, with the kinds of materials you work with. I wonder if you'd speak about clay in the studio.
Yeah, well, I think it even goes to something I was thinking about, you know, when you were talking about residencies and what you, you know, look for after an artist has gone to one is, you know, there's a part of me that's addicted to the surprise, right, the surprise of life, and not knowing what's going to happen next, and you kind of put yourself in certain positions, and you let go of the results, right? I can make my work. I focus on my work, but I don't actually have control over what really happens to it afterwards, how people think or feel about it, you know, what impact it's going to have. But, you know, I focus on my work. And so I think that, you know, in making, there's also that part of me that I don't know how a piece is going to come together. And so there's this really great charge of energy to be engaging with the unknown, to be engaging with the surprise. And so it leads the way. And so when my work, you know, as I'm making a piece and I get this feeling that this large shape, you know, wants to be embroidered, which is going to be very demanding on my body to do that, I can't say no to it. And so I think, you know, in thinking about play, there's an openness when you're in that energy of play. And as long as I have that openness to my work, I'm going to give it what it needs, and it's going to tell me what it needs. I know that sounds maybe very esoteric. You know, and then there's another sense of when I start to plan out a painting. So I make all my drawings. You know, sometimes it's just thumbnail sketches. Sometimes I'm making fully realized drawings, you know, right out of my hands, you know, with gouache and different acrylics and graphite onto paper. And then I have to start to decide if one is going to be a painting, how is it going to be a painting? How am I going to construct it? What part should be fabric? What kind of fabric? Should it be quilted? What kind of pattern? How should I think about paint application? You know, all these different elements. And so in that sense, play really starts to ramp up as I'm designing a quilt. I may take out graph paper and start to play with the quilt pattern and use different colors to color in and see where can I get a buzz with contrast or with different color combinations. You know, pulling out all my different fabrics that I have and starting to just kind of feel and map out what should happen in the painting. So in that sense, that part of the planning has a ton of play associated with the process.
Right. A lot of your work feels playful to begin with, in color and in shapes, and it always feels to me like you're having a great time. I think also within play, you know, play is kind of, it requires some experimentation and risk-taking. And I think those are also essential in a healthy studio practice, to allow yourself to push and to make mistakes but learn, and something will come from those mistakes. And I think play is a big part of it that allows you to experiment and take risk.
Well, and that's interesting because last year when I was planning out my show, my exhibition with the Landon Gallery, you know, I titled the show Wild Child, and just reflecting, you know, on different family narratives, you know, my own, my grandmother's, this child I was about to have. I was very pregnant when I was making that show. And, you know, I really thought about how when I was a teenager, I was very much a wild child. And, you know, at this point, and for quite a while, you know, I've had a very stable life. You know, I have a very nice, stable life. But it's in my art making that then I can engage in risk. You know, that I can engage in play. I mean, I'm very playful in my own life, but that the studio, that space, and that the psychic space of a painting can kind of become a zone in which to, you know, let loose. Like, I can work so hard on a painting for, you know, weeks, and or embroider something for 4 days straight, like 10 hours a day. And then the last thing I'm going to do is add some fluid acrylic paint, and it can make or break the whole thing. And so in that space, I create the risk. I create the chance. I create a moment of needing to problem solve if it doesn't go right. And I think that charge really keeps your work alive and doesn't feel like something that's kind of vacuum sealed, like, oh, I made a plan and I executed a plan. I want that charge.
I remember seeing Wild Child, not in person, but seeing the images, and I remember writing to you because I was so powerfully struck by the work in that particular exhibition, because your pregnancy is so apparent. I could feel, I mean, it affected my body in that way. And so it's
well,
sort of that.
Making that show was, I was at a residency in this very small town of Texas, Corsicana. And that is one of the most monastic experiences I've had at a residency. It was the smallest residency I've ever done. There was only two other people, and they were extreme introverts. So, like, I ate dinner alone every night.
Wow.
Like, my studio kind of became a second womb that I was living in, you know, mm-hmm. with this, you know, baby that was, you know, I was 5 and 6 months pregnant at that time. And so the quietness of that residency while I'm going through one of, you know, the most radical physical transformations, there was like no other show was going to be made but that one, you know?
Right. Well, it was just full of joy, and I felt the softness, but I felt the joy. I mean, there were so many elements in that show that I thought it was a breakout moment for you, actually. It was a beautiful time. We're running out of time, so I want to rush ahead to a few other things I wanted to explore with you. You've shown in Europe, I believe.
Not that much, actually. No.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I'm not going to ask you that question. I want to know what you think about this digital age we're in and viewing your work in a viewing room or on the computer. Do you have thoughts about this?
It's one of those things where I don't, because I'm just so not interested in it. I mean, it's going to be part of what happens. And I know, you know, I mean, even before this moment of, you know, more viewing rooms happening, you know, a lot of collectors are getting PDFs and press people are getting PDFs, and that's how they're kind of experiencing the work firsthand digitally to begin with. And so to me, it's kind of cliche or lazy as it is. It's okay, it's a necessary evil. Or not evil, but just a necessary part of the process at this point. And so, you know, on my end, I try to take good detail images of my work so that some sense of materiality can try and communicate through the digital. But I think one of the things I'm happy about is that from the translation of a person's experience going from digital to seeing my work in person, I'm you know, proud to say that most people will tell me that, you know, more is revealed to them in person.
Of course.
But that's not the case for all artists. You know, some people are kind of disappointed when they see the work in person. You know, maybe the paint application doesn't really spark any energy for them, or you know, they feel like they already kind of comprehended everything and nothing new is revealed. And so I would rather be on this other side where, you know, people like the image, and then when they are able to get in person, so much more is revealed. So they, you know, it slows down the time in which they spend with the work, which is sometimes my ultimate goal.
Right. What is the most important piece of advice you would offer an artist coming out of grad school that isn't written in? Okay.
I mean, you're just going to be afforded the ability to make your work in a way that your normal life is not going to be able to give you, unless you're independently wealthy, which is your own business, you know. But if you're, you know, coming from a more working class background, you know, you're going to need to find that precious time. And so I've never found it anywhere but an artist residency program. And then when I was able to get to a certain part of my career where I could not have to have a day job, you know, then I can have, you know, that day in, day out relationship with making my work. But coming out of grad school, you're probably not going to be there right away.
What do you think about MFA shows and selling the work?
What is it?
What are your thoughts on MFA exhibitions and the work being sold?
MFA exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, MFA exhibitions is kind of like our debutante balls. you know, and so, yeah, I think that as a young artist, you should try to spend as much time with your work leading up to those MFA shows so that you can have potentially the best vision of your work out there for people to see. When I was in grad school, I studied with Valerie Jardong, and she told me pretty early on, you know, don't exhibit while you're in school. Don't try to have your career yet. That's not where you're at. That's not what this is about. And she said, you know, I've seen artists go out and get cut down, and you're treated like a professional the minute you start exhibiting. You know, so focus on your work. And that's what I did. And so having that NFA show to me was like my first, you know, real moment of showing my full vision. I was lucky in having a very large space to show in, and so I had large paintings. I had seven paintings. You could feel a world. You know, and it's not like I, you know, had people banging down the door to buy them, but my one, you know, piece of advice would be just don't sell your whole show. Like, you should keep a couple pieces for your archive, for yourself, and for your own personal studio reference, to kind of always know where you've come from.
Well, you know, I've seen a few artists who had talent and had vision. I saw their careers ruined early on because of heavy attention during an MFA show and a sellout and being approached by numerous galleries and pressed to produce and produce and produce. And within a year and a half, the career floundered. So I wonder from an artist's perspective how that feels. I certainly appreciate the need for an MFA show, but to sell the work puts an edge on it. And I just wanted to know how that feels from an artist, a young artist's point of view, whether it's a positive experience or.
Yeah, I mean,
seems pretty intense to me.
Yeah, for me, it was more of who saw my show and then who they talked about to my show with. And then I got opportunities from those. It wasn't sales. It was more of, you know, in the 3 months following my MFA show, you know, you plant seeds and it takes time for them to grow. And so then I'm being contacted by somebody, you know, whose friend saw or whose, you know, art colleague saw my show and they want to do a visit. And those things led to actual real sustained relationships in the art world versus like the quick high of, you know, selling your pieces from your MFA show.
Right. Good. Well, I'm glad. I think that's, those are important words for other students to hear. My final question has to do with this strange time we're in with COVID-19 and the quarantine. Has it given you an opportunity to make some new discoveries?
You know, it has, and I haven't wanted to be an artist who missed out on that, you know, because I know it's a specifically kind of paused, quiet moment, which doesn't always feel that way with a small baby. But I have... you know, in the transition to relocate, you know, we chose to relocate to my in-laws' house. And, you know, in the first initial period of feeling lost and kind of at sea, I had also just lost my father right before quarantine really took over. Thank you. And so, you know, I was feeling lost and I didn't really have my grounding. And so I turned to my work, as I always do, but I just started making these really loose Japanese ink painting drawings. And it was about finding a space to not judge myself, but not be in production mode and not be thinking, I need to make drawings because they need to lead to paintings. It was, I'm in a moment and I don't know who I am right now. And I'm going to do what I always do. I'm going to turn to my art because my art has always saved me. You know, and whether those become something or not, it's still not a question I need to even feel like I have to answer. And then that kind of exploration led to, let me get some fancy crayons. And now I'm making these drawings with crayons and trying to get a different texture into my paint or my drawings. I bought a nice set of watercolors. The learning curve on the watercolors is a lot higher, so I'm not really that encouraged, but, you know, I keep going. And, you know, now I do have my grounding again, and I am working on paintings, and I have been, you know, drawing, but I still have these other lines of kind of, like, looser experimentation.
Oh, I would love to see those sometimes.
It's in the air, you know, definitely.
Yeah, you must send me some images to see. I'm curious what's going on there. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. I'm going to let you go because I promised you 45 minutes and Cyrus probably needs your attention very soon. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk more about the baby, and I delight in watching him on Instagram and watching him grow so fast. The most recent one where he was toddling through the grass and so cute, but I'm enjoying that. And, you know, I think also a tribute to you that you've been able to work into a new marriage, have a child, and it seems like your career hasn't missed a beat. And I admire your work ethic. I admire your integrity. And as you know, I'm a fan of your work. So I will continue to watch with keen interest.
Oh, thanks, Joanne. This conversation has been a real intellectual highlight of my month.
Oh, good. Thank you. Well, it's an experiment, but you know, I do a lot of, I haven't been able to do as many studio visits as I wish, and they're important to me, and the information I get from studios as I pass it on to graduate students seems to be very valuable. So I thought, well, why not, you know, do something like this where they can hear directly from the artists themselves about what this world looks like beyond the classroom and out into the real world. So I thank you for taking the time, and I will transcribe this and get you a copy, and we're going to keep it in our archives and use it in some capacity for our graduate our curatorial study platform.
Great. Well,
so you be well.
To have an interview and all that time and energy that goes into it. So. And, yeah, you keep enjoying your beautiful Colorado fishing.
Yes, I will. I will indeed. Thank you, Amanda. You stay well.
All right.
And we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.